actually, for now. A very warm welcome to everyone. Thank you for being here. I'm Natalie Fenton. I'm from the Media and Communications Department, and it gives me enormous pleasure to introduce tonight's discussion. Do come in. Come in. Don't worry. The purpose of which is to launch this book, The Contradictions of Media Power, by our very own Des Friedman. We have Des and John Pilger in discussion tonight, both people who have, in their work, in very different but equally compelling ways, taken power and the corruption of power and dissected it, exposed it, critiqued it, and laid it bare. Kicking off the discussion, we have John Pilger, who doesn't really need any introduction, but just a couple of things for those of you who may not know his work too well. In his 20s, John became the youngest journalist to receive Britain's highest award for journalism, Journalist of the Year, and was the very first person to win it twice. Moving to the United States, he reported the upheavals there in the late 60s and 70s. He marched with America's poor from Alabama to Washington following the assassination of Martin Luther King. He was actually in the same room when Robert Kennedy, the presidential candidate, was assassinated in June 1968. He went on to produce a host of incredible work that not only exposed wrongs, but also campaigned and raised money to help people affected by those wrongs. In Cambodia, in East Timor, for children damaged at birth by the drug thalidomide, investigative journalism of the very best kind in a campaigning context. He's won an Emmy and a BAFTA for his numerous documentaries, which have also won numerous US and European awards, such as the Royal Television Society's Best Documentary. His articles appear worldwide. In 2003, he was awarded the prestigious Sophie Prize for 30 years of exposing injustice and promoting human rights. In 2009, he was awarded the Sydney Peace Prize. His website, do look at it, it's got everything you need to know on it, runs the banner quote, "It's not enough for journalists to see themselves as mere messengers without understanding the hidden agendas of the message and the myths that surround it." John, it is a very great honour to have you with us. Please welcome. About our Des before he kicks off as well.
Shorter, much shorter.
Much shorter. But if it's okay to have favourites in our profession, then I would say uncategorically that Des Friedman is one of my all-time favourites. Des Friedman is Professor of Media and Communications in the Department of Media and Communications here at Goldsmiths. He's the author of Politics of Media Policy, co-author of Misunderstand the Internet, and co-editor of several books, including The Assault on Universities and Media and Terrorism. And tonight we celebrate this book. He's a founding member and chair of the Media Reform Coalition and a national committee member of the Campaign for Press and Broadcasting Freedom. He writes regularly for the Huffington Post, The Guardian, Open Democracy, and numerous other publications. Like John, he's a committed political activist, one of those mighty rare but mighty fine academics who doesn't see a distinction between knowledge and intellectual labour and the wider social world. Someone who sees real politics all around us, and rather than hiding between the pages of his latest book, actually goes out there and tries to live it. He is, as Robert McChesney says on the back cover here, one of the preeminent media scholars in the world. Toby Miller says he's among the world's leading analysts of media power. I think that's a bit rich. I'm going to say he is the world's leading analyst of media power. Des, whee! Words about the book, how are you playing it?
Yeah,
yes? And then John is going to enter into conversation with Des, and then we're throwing it open to the floor. So please have your questions ready. We want this to be as interactive and discursive as possible.
Well, thank you for that introduction. I'll probably blow it in the next couple of an hour and a half. But it is a Q&A, so I hope you have your questions. But it wouldn't be a proper Q&A without us just saying a few things to start with. And I just wanted to say why I wrote the book, and there are just three reasons. One is because I wanted to highlight the importance of power, because I cannot believe that you can have any serious discussion about the media without addressing power up front. And remember, this is a time when for many commentators and journalists and academics, actually, there's less of a need to talk about power, allegedly, because of the new platforms and technologies that are allegedly decentralising and dispersing power. Remember, you know, I follow Rupert Murdoch on Twitter simply to get the gems of wisdom, like his one from a couple of years ago, which was, haven't you heard of the internet? No one controls the media or will ever again. The first thing was just to put media on the agenda. Second, it's not just any, I hope, understanding of media. It's also an understanding of media, of power, that's related to the control of the resources that are needed to operate inside the media. So it's not just about giant corporations, whether they're new or they're old ones, and therefore the questions of ownership and concentration that we need to address, but it's also about the whole series of connections as well that are hidden or simply taken for granted between the media and other elites. So it's about the ideologies that they hold in common, the sets of ideas that they propose. It's about the shared social and political environments that I try and describe in the book. It's about common views on things like terror, the environment, or whether there is an environmental crisis, about their understanding of democracy, immigration, racism, and so on. Shared ideas that I think help to explain a lot of the commercial mainstream media that we see. And I think the power to speak, which is the heart of the media's role, is not an equal one. If you have the backing of a venture capital fund or a mogul or a government, then you're going to be able to be heard by many more people than is allegedly the case, despite our formal freedom to say what we want. And I just think, therefore, this affects the nature of the speech that there is. It affects your attitudes towards gender and race, towards attitudes towards the poor or the celebration of wealth. And I just think, I mean, how many examples could we go through? But you just think about the absence of pro-independence voices in the recent Scottish referendum. You think of the lack of context. This is no accident. The lack of context in coverage of this summer over Gaza, where the struggle between Israel and the Palestinians is somehow seen as a sort of equal tit for tat between, you know, two equal sides. And you also think, I mean, this is just the latest bugbear, is the lack of humility of all those commentators who have the gall to attack someone like Russell Brand for not having the economic expertise to be able to talk about the need for radical change and revolution. I mean, we could go through many of these. So that's the second, is the kind of understanding of power. But the third one is the but, because John could talk about the corruption of power for hours, weeks, days and years, I guess. But I just, the main reason for writing the book was because I thought, in a way, I wanted just to try and go a bit further, and also because I'm not a pessimist. And if you just buy the media as a very powerful block, full stop, then in a way we just give up and go home. And so for many people, it's important to try and have another reading of power as well, because I don't think things are quite that simple. For most of us in this room, we know that not every coder, journalist, editor, tape editor, not newspaper editor. You know, not everyone sets out to tell lies or to be involved in propaganda. And actually, I think we should recognise the fact that the media sometimes have to struggle to enforce their legitimacy and their credibility on ordinary people who are, as we know increasingly, are suspicious of elites and suspicious of voices of authority who tell them what to think. We don't believe them. And I said, so that's why the book was written, to try and get to grips with what I see as this problem, that the media are this powerful bloc, but also they run up against rebellions, refusals, resistance on the part of ordinary people. So I just wanted to end my 1 minute just by reminding us of some of the cracks that are there, by drawing on John to a certain extent. I mean, how is it? I still don't know. You're going to tell us, I hope. How you managed to get some of the front covers, and these aren't marginal. These aren't the things that are buried in Channel 4 at 3 in the morning. This is the front cover of the Daily Mirror, which at the time sold, 4 million copies? The coverage of Cambodia, as far as I know, that was an issue which sold out. But also we have more recently, you know, the coverage of East Timor. I mean, this is recent history. Now, if you haven't seen it, this is real. I did not Photoshop any of this. These are real covers. With John's name on that one, I can't remember if you wrote that or not, during the war on Iraq. This is consistent anti-war campaigning. And this is my favourite, the very subtle mirror front cover. you couldn't have done a better job with that. Now, the fact is that those picked, they're not there, these covers, because of an inherent liberalism inside the media, or an easy diversity in media markets. They're there because I think capitalism, and through foreign policy struggles away, it's riddled with contradictions that are reinforced and acted on by ordinary people, and that we shouldn't forget the fact that we deserve and we struggle for good hospitals, good, decent education, decent jobs, decent housing. Why should we not struggle also for decent representations and decent stories about the world that try and tell the truth which is so often buried? So that's a long way, sorry, of saying that actually if you see power in terms of the distribution of resources inside the media, then I guess rather shamefully and unobjectively just try and use the book to argue for a redistribution of those resources to produce a media that actually befits all of us in this room. Thank you very much.
I mean, Dennis is absolutely right to analyse media power. The whole essence of media is not about information, it's about power. The power of the media is the most formidable power in our society. It's become far greater than when those front pages were published. One of them 1979, the other something of an aberration in 2003, and briefly the Daily Mirror supported the anti-war movement against the invasion of Iraq. So, but today the media is, as the father of propaganda, modern propaganda, Edward Bernays, described, an invisible government. It's a government that is in the government, is in the government's vested interests, it's in the media. The Prime Minister is a PR man by trade, not a very good one, but a PR man. That's all he is. He shouldn't be taken seriously except for he has a position. That position allows him certain aspects of the power in this country. But the real power resides in propaganda and in media. That's true now all over the world. And I don't, perhaps Des and I might disagree in that, I don't think it's about being optimistic or pessimistic. It's about recognizing a reality. Yes, the media isn't a monolith. And yes, there are cracks. And perhaps the only truth tellers are the honourable exceptions to a rule. I actually think that applies in the Academy as well. Des is a very unusual person in the Academy. I don't have a huge amount of time for the teaching of journalism, although I'm closely associated with an excellent journalism school, I must say, at Lincoln University, which has all my archives. And it has it because they too are exceptional, just as Des and the people here at Goldsmiths have always been exceptional. That's not true at quite a number of universities that simply provide fodder for a media machine. I've been in some media schools and spoken to the heads of journalism. And it really has been like speaking to the editor-in-chief of the News of the World. So I think we have to regard the teaching of journalism as well as the practice of journalism as part of the same monolith of power. Now, as I say, this is not simply a pessimistic view. It's the reality of what power is in the media. I'll give one example before I think I hand over to a Q&A, and that is that in the run-up to the invasion of Iraq, the journalism played a very, very critical role in ensuring that invasion took place, especially in the United States, which has constitutionally the freest press in the world. Now, in discussing this with a number of very distinguished colleagues in the United States and in this country following the invasion, they were unanimous in saying that had journalists, in responsible positions, both in television and in newspapers, especially television because of its power, had they questioned the deceptions, had they challenged them, had they done their job as journalists, had they, as Dan Rather of CBS said, asked the critical second question, instead of amplifying and echoing the lies that were told as pantomime. You'll remember Colin Powell before the United Nations, a pantomime act. All of it lies, all of it. Had they done that job, they believed that that invasion might not have taken place. Now, that may well be an optimistic view, but the fact that they were saying that, and these are people from well inside the media establishment on both sides of the Atlantic, saying that had journalists done their job, that invasion might not have taken place and hundreds of thousands of people will be alive today. That's the power of the media.
I want to hand straight over to a Q&A, actually. So anybody, any questions at all to Des or to John? We've got right at the front here. Alejandro. Say who you are,
John. John Dancing, journalist, hello, pleased to meet you. And what do you think has been the most effective story you've ever done, and what's the biggest regret?
Oh, I don't think it comes down to one. I think degrees of effectiveness, quite a few ineffective ones, I have to say, that I thought might be effective. I mean, I'm not sure how we judge effectiveness. I suppose I would judge it by whether I had evidence that the disclosures in the story reached a large number of people and caused a debate, had a reaction. That wasn't a passive reception, that it had a reaction amongst people. Certainly the Cambodia stories had a pretty big impact. So that's for me. That's what journalism is about. You. It's the old maxim of information is power. You do your best to give people that power. And if because without that power, nothing changes. So it's providing that information and having some evidence that it's caused a debate, it's caused discussion, and perhaps it's even led to some change.
Okay, I can see three hands, one in the middle, then one at the front and one at the very front. So maybe closest mic, yeah, go back in.
Do you think that you're challenging photojournalism and your subject matter has caused you to be marginalised in the media at all?
I can hardly say it. I don't think I've been marginalised. Well, my films go out on ITV.
I'm not saying now, but has it been a struggle is what I mean.
Say that again, sorry.
Has it been a struggle for you to get...
Yes, yeah. Big struggle. Mm. Yeah. Anthony Hayward has written a book about, pretty well it's about the struggle I've had over the years to simply maintain a position in television. And I'm amazed when I read it. I've forgotten most of it as you try to forget all these battles, but he's researched them and struggles with various authorities over Ireland when we weren't supposed to really do anything on Ireland. And many others. Yes, it's the struggle, but that's really should be part of journalism. If there isn't a struggle, and you're working within a system that is inherently hostile to truth-telling. And I don't say that as satire, I mean that. It is hostile to truth-telling. One only has to see the media reaction to the truth-tellers, Edward Snowden, Julian Assange, the bitter reaction of people who shamed much of the media almost at a stroke. So, yes, there's always a struggle within it. That's not to say that there are numerous honourable exceptions, whether or not they can make their voices heard or demonstrated through their work effectively is another thing.
Bess, can I ask you to respond to that, on how you think media power then encloses those debates in particular ways, and whether you think it's got any worse in recent times?
Well, it's a struggle for every journalist to get a story told, but obviously the perspective that you're adopting is going to be a little bit easier to sell should it not ruffle any feathers, should it be much more to the pleasure of your editor. And the fact is now, you just look at where the centre is. The centre just seems to keep moving towards the right. Mm. So if you're going to frame your story over whatever an issue it is, let alone immigration, then it's not a level playing field. You think of austerity now. There is so much capacity for important truth-telling around austerity, not least because the public's views on austerity should be represented. The latest figures are something like 46% of people think that there either wasn't a need for austerity or think that it's gone too far. Now, I defy you to find a media outlet that adequately reflects that point of view. I mean, the few academic studies that have been on this show that, you know, that significant, but it's almost the majority, is not reflected. And so this is partly, you know, it's the impact of the Murdochs making their presence felt, that this is not the kind of, you know, an anti-austerity story is not what's going to get you promotion. It's the role of advertisers as well. But again, it's just a shared ideological view which permeates so many of the institutions that makes it hard for those journalists who want to, you know, ask the tough questions and ask the second question. It makes it very hard to do. And I'm sure there are journalists, I assume there are lots of journalists in this room who are constantly frustrated. They're not brainwashed, but how easy is it to get that story out? And there are different levels of systems that just prevent that taking place.
It's very important, though, isn't it, Des, that young journalists are encouraged to get that story out. But they don't fall victim to the idea of that a certain cynicism about a people ordains them as journalists, as so often they're taught, rather than a skepticism about the system. Those two are often confused at a very early stage with young journalists, particularly idealistic young journalists who come up against a system where they realise that there is something called a censorship by omission. You leave out. You don't really discuss what you leave out, but it's left out. And the encouragement is so important for young journalists like that, that they are encouraged to navigate through the system, they are encouraged to stand up wherever possible they can, not all the time, but that individual, that individual sense of themselves as journalists, not as simply part of a system, is a critical part of a navigation that not always succeeds, but certainly doesn't fail in a wholesale way, as so much of journalism demonstrates as a failure. I mean, Des mentioned the austerity. That's a very, very good example. If you look back to 2008, you might remember the stories on BBC News and all over the papers. The banks were suddenly crooks. You know, when Northern Rock collapsed, the banks were crooks. RBA, they're all crooks, they're all exposed. The Guardian was full of tombstones of copy about how the banks were rotten from inside. It was the story, a glimpse. That story ended after about 3 months, and it was turned around that it wasn't really the banks. Yes, we had stories about how those who were the head of the banks had ripped off and had very large bonuses and so on. But it all came down to a national debt and a kind of controlled narrative, if I'll use what almost sounds dead like an academic term. A controlled narrative, you know, was there, and it's called austerity. And that debt had to be paid off. Why? Why did it have to be paid off? And the people that you quote, that's a majority, really. I mean, if you're getting that in a poll, 46%, that's a majority of the people, proving again that most people are ahead of the media. They usually are. They're ahead of the media as far as going to war. They're ahead of the media in terms of the economics of their lives, how they live. So we saw a glimpse of the truth that this massive criminality, and that's what it was, from Wall Street right across to the City of London, subprime lending, hedge funds, all the rotten architecture had collapsed, almost collapsed, not quite, was picked up by the government, and banks were nationalized. Banks were nationalized without any conditions. Extraordinary. Off they went. Few conditions, but not many. The Bank of England remained privatized. Nothing changed. So the consciousness of how this happened, which was there for, I suppose, about 6 months, was, thanks to a very effective propaganda system, shifted that it wasn't the bank's fault, it was our fault.
Let's take another question.
Thanks. So, actually, both partially answered the question I was originally going to ask, which was really about, whether the journalist saying, if only we'd asked the right questions, the Iraq war might not have happened, for example. And I was going to ask whether you felt that was kind of almost a sort of a collective, unconscious decision by journalists, or whether there was a larger power somewhere behind the scenes, you know, leading them to that conclusion. You've kind of touched on that by saying it's easier to get sell your story if you're playing the up to the right message. But being that I haven't read Des's book yet, but hope to, yes. But being that some of the argument here seems to be that the power really now is not with governments, and you talked about the Prime Minister not being the real one with the power. You know, where do you have any sort of insights as to really why the power of the media might be a sort of leading government policy in a certain direction, or at least sort of pushing particular agendas that you can't immediately see how those might be aligned with the media's interest per se, but seem to be sort of maybe aligned to something that none of us really quite understand. Have I framed that?
John. I mean, there's no conspiracy. Doesn't have to be. There are shared assumptions. And those assumptions run very, very deep. Whereas a few years ago, more than a few, I would think a challenge to those assumptions came in from the margins, briefly. I would say we're talking about the 1960s and 70s. And that came into the media. If you look back on some of the newspapers then, even newspapers that are called right-wing newspapers now, you will find a recognition of certain struggles, of certain of the rights of the majority, if I can oversimplify it, you will find that in the newspapers, because it was then considered respectable by the right wing. That has moved back, it's gone. And as Des says, I don't like using the terms of left and right in terms of the media, because there isn't any left. I know that's amusing, but and I don't say it for effect, there just isn't. And it's about time people stop using the term. You can use it historically, or you can use it in terms of one's own feelings and political leanings, if you wish, but there is no left in terms of media. There are gradations of it, most certainly. It's just a denial of reality to say there is. And when The Guardian talks about the right-wing press, I'm amused, as if The Guardian is not a part of the right-wing press, but of course it is. So I think that shift in politics that came out of a period of extraordinary upheaval and turmoil, the 60s and 70s, and of challenge right across the board, working people in terms of young people's attitude to culture and war and violence, the changes were quite extraordinary in people's consciousness. There was a response to that right throughout what I would call the establishment media. It allowed something of this to be represented. And I was a beneficiary of this. There's no question about that. That was the time when I joined the Daily Mirror, which became a serious tabloid, a Labour-supporting tabloid, but produced front pages like that. And not only front pages, the entire paper of that issue, the entire paper was about Cambodia. And it sold out, proving a point that the idea of Murdoch's idea of you give the public what they want, that is, you give them rubbish, is always wrong. It's if you give the public McDonald's and McDonald's, they can only have McDonald's. So that happened then, and since then politics have tightened and narrowed, and the media has played a critical role in that. Without the media, I don't think we would be living with such extreme politics as we are at the moment. I mean, we're in the term perpetual war has become a kind of cliche. the assumption that there is a national debt that has to be paid back is regarded as a truth, but a fact that runs entirely through the media. As Des quotes, the public view of that, and the public is right. So we're at a time of intense propaganda. We'll be here all night. I mean, at the moment, there is a campaign to build a new Cold War. It is an active, open campaign. And the most vociferous crusaders are not necessarily the Murdoch press at all. They are the so-called small L liberal press. Read the editorial in the Observer last Sunday, or in the Guardian yesterday. The crusade is on, a new Cold War.
I'm going to take two questions in a row so we can get through some more. I've seen the gentleman in the middle has been, and the one in front. So we'll take two and then maybe three. So you right in front as well. So one, two, three, and then we're going to go over this side, and I promise it'll be you.
Thank you. Pete Rogers, a man from the pub, really, no more than that. A lot of us think, and I don't know how many, because we don't have enough contact with each other, that media and anything like it will always dance to the tune of power. It's got all the money, and they will ask themselves the question, do I want to be a hero for holding power to account, or do I want to be a rich man? And that is an unfortunate truth. They're viable. I personally wouldn't think that I lived in a society that had a genuinely poor press, having noticed that nobody asked Aung San Suu Kyi, for instance, who represents the greater calamity for humankind, the Burmese generals or the coalition that invaded Iraq? Now that is an extremely difficult question, but without that, she is used to launder the profound evil and our press. Nobody in our press even thought about that. The problem is power. Sorry, the problem is power. But here is a very short quote from Britain's widest distributed financial magazine. Voters may fantasize that they set the course for the United States of America, but it is the elite who are in the driver's seat. The public merely votes for whichever candidates have done the best job of hoodwinking it. Then the elite use states' police power to transfer wealth and power from voters to themselves. And that's actually from a financial magazine. But the problem is power corrupting.
Okay,
I wonder if you think that.
Okay, we're going to hold that. Can we keep the comments shorter?
Sorry.
So we can get through. No, it's fine. It's just we've got to a lot of people want to speak. So,
In terms of... Okay, so the problem seems to be monopoly within the media, the Rupert Murdochs and so on. So then there's the theory of a pluralist theory, so if, you know, decentralized and, you know, not one person owns, you know, all of media. How do you think that would work? Because you're still talking about the media being run as a business, even if it's in a small scale, and, you know, profits need to be made. So do you think that can work?
That one's going to be for you, then the woman right in front.
Yeah, so I think lots of people are losing their faith in the media, and I think about something like 40% of people get their news now from the internet and their feeds and Facebook and so on. Do you think there are lots of people obviously doing citizen journalism, do you think it's possible to create an independent network or an independent media organisation? I mean, it's something that we're trying to do where we can bring in people's feeds, and that can function as something that's totally away from corporate power or from business interests or from proprietor interests. Do you think it's possible to do?
That's good. Three questions. I'm going to ask Des to respond first.
Well, yeah, in reverse order, please try everything you can. Everyone should use the possibilities that are there to get the viewpoints which are so often marginalised out there. The trouble is, I don't think that will ever become mainstream. That's a bigger ideological question, which is where the issues... And let's not forget that when people say, which drives me mad, that they just say that there's some easy transition to a more pluralistic online environment. Yes, it's true. Obviously, the numbers of people who are consuming online news is going up. But the suppliers and the sources of online news are the same voices as offline, by and large. And it's staggering how much they map onto each other. You know, it is not an accident that the world's most popular online newspaper is the Daily Mail. Yippee, what a result for us. It's gone from being the second most popular UK newspaper to being the world's most favourite newspaper online. So there's work to be done online without in any way stopping the possibility of citizen journalism. Secondly, in terms of monopoly, it's a great question. This is the long game. And to shift, to fully address the lack of representation and the warmongering and everything else of the mainstream media is not going to be done overnight. But a first place to start, I think partly because people are so fed up with it, is to start with some of the giants as they are put to us. I think people generally are very suspicious of the giant corporations because they're suspicious of lots of institutions that they see are representative of vested interests. So I think it's a reformist demand. It's a classic reformist demand, is that these companies who dominate the national conversation, we should do something about that. That doesn't deal with the Financial Times. It doesn't deal with the Guardian. But once you start to address this as an issue, start to build movements around who has the power to speak and what are they saying, Then you have to move on, which comes to the third question, which is about the media dancing to the tune of power. That's absolutely right. The question is, whose power? And if you only look at one source of power, you marginalise what I think is very significant, which is the users, the listeners. Most of the time, you know, we're just doing a job, cooking dinner, walking dogs. But actually, there are moments in history where all the major historical changes have been made by ordinary people. I just do not see why that is not going to be replicated in the sphere of media that has been in terms of civil rights, voting, and so on. So, yes, their power is so often dominating, but we have to get to the situation where, from below, we're making these demands through the movement for engagement. The anti-war movement was so significant, it was huge, it posed the question very starkly, and it saw an expression, not in that slide, but in the other slide, that there was, not because, who's the fine editor at the time, not because he's a reliable ally of the anti-war movement.
Morgan.
Thank you, Piers Morgan. He's comfortable on US broadcast television because he felt that he, in some ways, this was a constituency that shouldn't be ignored. That wasn't because he's a great guy. It's because the anti-war movement was on the street. So I guess that's my way. It is a long game. You start with what is possible now, but you realise there has to be, it's going to take a huge ideological clash, and that really is where the movement's political change comes in.
But that didn't get any publicity. 500,000 people.
Sorry. Yeah, we do have to take it in turns, otherwise people can't hear. John, do you want to respond?
I think we've got to, we've got to really seriously demystify. I think we've almost got to stop using the term mainstream. They're not the mainstream. It's a misnomer. The mainstream is the poll that you quoted. That's the mainstream. We're always drawn to look through this prism of something called a mainstream. It isn't. It's actually an extreme. What could be more extreme than various institutions that propagate rapacious, illegal war, deception about economic policies? What could be more extreme than that? What is mainstream about that? I mean, I think in the teaching of journalism, we have to almost take back concepts that have been expropriated. And almost everything has been expropriated. The words democracy and reform, mainstream, they all matter because we use them so often. And they've all been hijacked. They've all been hijacked and given, emptied of their once noble meanings often, and filled up with an Orwellian inversion. In fact, if I can bear it, I'll sit down and watch one 10 o'clock news to monitor or deconstruct it, if I get to write something with a pad, and do all the Orwellians through it. Everything has been inverted. And, you know, it's very important, staying on this mainstream, we're talking about monopolies and big companies and bad capitalists and everything. The most effective propagandist institution in this country is the BBC. Way ahead, and that's why I part company with the Leveson Inquiry, like a sideshow almost about the wrongs of Rupert Murdoch, and sure, they're wrongs, all right. Wrongs that are not going to be really extend up to the company. I read the other day that the prosecution of News Corp or News UK, as it now is, that is the prosecution of Rupert Murdoch, is very unlikely to happen. Got a few editors and half a dozen journalists, and that's considered a justice in the media. The greatest propaganda institution in Britain is the BBC. It is that because it has the greatest reputation. It has the greatest credibility. It has a worldwide reputation, some of it earned. In news and current affairs, almost none of it earned. And and I don't say that, again, satirically. And so the idea that we concentrate on the demons, Murdoch, even, there's the Daily Mail, bad enough, very powerful. Because they, in a way, the Mail and the BBC and all of them complement each other and follow each other. The agendas in the Mail will be an agenda on Newsnight that night. So it's understanding that broad spectrum of propaganda and what it means and how it affects all of us. And reclaiming the language. You know, language is so neglected in this, but the language, one clip just sitting in the minicab coming here, he had something, had LBC on. And there, you know, because I'm a prisoner in the back and I listen to it. Then, you know, there it is, one cliche after the other. Cameron says there's going to be a recession. You know, so that's the news. Cameron says there's going to be a recession. Recession. Miliband will reply to him, and various press releases will be read out at news right across. Tonight, it'll be across the BBC, across ITV, Channel 4, and all the rest of it. Here and there, there'll be glimpses of what might be, what might be the truth. That's the mainstream. So when we get hooked on monopoly, be careful. Because the whole thing is a monopoly. And it doesn't just include bad capitalists. It includes one of the great state institutions in this country. What do we do? Your question, where does it go? Yes. I mean, the most hopeful thing is that there is a rejection of all this by many, many people who don't go online to look at the Daily Mail, but who do go online to look at a number of websites that they trust, they've learned to trust, they've found out about, they've pursued, the websites have become a reliable source of something for them. I think Facebook is quite different. Facebook is a distraction for many of us, you know. It's very much about an introspection, a kind of organized introspection. And I think that's, you know, it might be fun and it might be helpful here and there, but it's a distraction. A pleasant distraction for some, but a distraction. I don't think it should be taken as a serious medium of news or widespread information. But there's plenty on the internet that gives us that. And, I mean, that's why there's a war on the internet. You know, reclaiming back the internet is not just the project of the Daily Mail, it's the project of big governments, Google and so on.
Take some more questions.
Yeah, okay.
On that thought.
Yeah, sort of continuing that thought, really. I wanted to ask both of you about whether you think there is a kind of growing kind of credibility or legitimacy crisis in the media, because it seems to me that, like John says, as it gets more and more, well, I'll say right wing, which I think it is, and it's like noticeably even over the last 6 months or a year, and more closer to a rightward moving political elite, more and more close to the corporations and so forth. I mean, obviously in general it's a bad thing, but at the same time it does seem to me that some of the credibility problems that Westminster has and that the bankers have and so forth is beginning to apply now to the media. And I think there's lots of interesting statistics about the number of people who do look for alternative independent sources and are getting more sceptical about it. And if you look at the opinion polls, 70% of the population want renationalisation of the railways, the gas, electricity, and so on and so forth. Now, that's something that no newspaper or no media outlet says. So, you know, that's interesting. Palestine, the majority of people now support the Palestinians in Britain. And that's completely in defiance of mass media. And so I think that's one question. And then just to reinforce what Des was saying, in certain circumstances, this can come full circle. And I do think Iraq was one of them, because I think what you had in Iraq is you did have a mass protest movement that started to influence the media. I remember the night before February 15, 2003, the weatherman came on and said, if you're going on the demo tomorrow, wrap up warm because it might be cold. So, you know, there are times when there's a kind of feedback in the other direction.
We'll take another one straight in front and then...
Well, I think the BBC's, like, the way it works so well is it has this veneer of impartiality. And I was wondering how it manages to maintain this and how, like, we could use that maybe and how they can even claim it at all. And if you think that's their biggest weapon.
Let's start with...
Just on the legitimacy... The latest polls, which I guess you won't find surprising, is that something like 20% of the public trust journalists in this country to tell the truth. And in a way, it's not a doubt. You know, you meet a journalist, you're a liar. I think that means it's about the institution of journalism as we've seen it in the last couple of years. And it's important that, because if you want to try and break open the cracks wherever possible, one of the people with whom you're going to do that are journalists. They're the most pissed off about not being able to do their jobs. So it's 20% is quite an amazing figure. You know, it's pretty much the same for estate agents. So the fact that these two institutions are at the same batting level is disturbing actually, but it's not. It's a sign of a very healthy public scepticism about institutions of power. Of course, we're not as good as the Australians, who, for reasons that will probably be quite familiar to you, 34% of Australians say that their media are, in their words, completely corrupt. So that's the place to go. If you want a lively media, activist movement, one in three. Now, how does that work? Does it mean that they do not consume any media? No, it doesn't. It means they consume it, and yet their daily lives, the fact that Australia is sending troops to places where it has no business, suggests to them that there is something wrong. And that gives me the optimism, I can't think of another word actually, it is an optimism that there is this radical disjuncture between the media that we get and it not representing what ordinary people think and their lives. And I think the question is how we exploit that gap. And of course, if I had the answer, you know, I would probably wouldn't be sitting here, as lovely as it is. But I mean, that's what we should, I think, some of us should be focusing on.
I think it does come, I think, you and your colleagues, Des, are in such important positions because young journalists now have to come through these institutions. And I do think it is about, it's why so much happens in schools. Or doesn't happen in schools, and why the teaching of young journalists that above all they must be independent. They must be independent of all systems. I mean, that very notion of independence, I would have thought, is almost unheard of. It's obfuscated in all the stuff like impartiality and objectivity, which have been utterly lobotomized as words, empty, they're meaningless. And I'm not sure that all journalists are all pissed off, Des, because go into the BBC and there are a lot who believe that. They believe that once they enter the portals, they rise to this nirvana of whatever it is, and that you should challenge them. You will see a kind of defensiveness as like a presence in the room, because a little part of their intellect knows that what you're saying is true, and that the whole notion of impartiality and objectivity as a cover for not actually pursuing the truth. that you can put two people in a discussion in a television studio and very successfully evade the truth, evade the salient part of it. Those subjects should be discussed where journalists are educated, where journalists are taught. So I think there's an enormous responsibility on media colleges where people go in and get media degrees and come out and then think they're going to pursue and want to pursue a media career. Your question about impartiality and objectivity, these are almost totemic words. They're like the other vocabulary that I think we have to start with to challenge every one of them. What do they mean? How can somebody, you reading the news at 10 o'clock, say in 20 seconds, utter two or three or four or more assumptions, all of which require challenging, most of which can't be stood up? You know, you long ago, when I was making a film undercover in Stalin's Czechoslovakia, and I went to the home of a novelist who was banned, and he was under house arrest. And he was one of the Charter 77 people, extraordinarily brave group. And he wouldn't buy that it's all gold over the other side of the wall in the west. He understood it. Czechoslovakia had a relatively recent history of being a functioning democracy, and he remembered that. And he said the difference is that we know our media, we know our television, we know our newspapers are a bunch of liars. We read between the lines. And so right across Eastern Europe, especially in Czechoslovakia, and very especially in Poland, there was Samizdat Theatre, there were various places where this critical public intelligence could receive information and impart information. And he said, you know, you live with your myths, you haven't learned to read between the lines. And I've really never forgotten that. I think that is sums up what we all should be doing, and that is reading between the lines. The idea that the whole propaganda system can simply be reformed, I think, is nonsense.
Okay, and then right in the back row, Alejandro.
Yes, I'd like to make a quote from one of John's earlier works, and he said, "As long as journalists know that they represent the people and viewers and not those who pay or employ them, then we have real journalism." My question therefore is, now, how does a modern day journalist, with all the economic problem all over and around him, how does he always represent only the people and not his employer? Will he not lose his job? Again, you said something that you like to follow stories before or after the event. And my question is, don't you think such stories will lose their immediacy?
I think that, if I understand you correctly, I just want to get this right. Why do journalists represent their employers and not the people?
Yes, you said a journalist should represent the people all the times, and not them, in one of your earlier works.
They do represent the people.
Yes, you know, yes, my question is,
they should. Got it. Okay.
Yeah. Okay.
And right on the back, we'll take just a couple in a row. This, yes. And then if you pass it to the...
Hello, John. I was wondering, my question really is, the how do you approach, say, you know, something like the Diego Garcia, when you sort of, the whole thing with the Queen, the special ceremony?
The Royal Prerogative.
Royal Prerogative. That's it, yeah. So something like that, you approach...
And Australia.
Something like that, you approach the secretive, you know, the things you've exposed that I've seen some of the films. I just wondered whether you've ever felt that you were threatened at all, or felt you were in danger by sort of exposing some of the more, you know, explosive elements.
You pass the one in front and then I'll come in.
Hi, John. Following on from that question from the gentleman there about who journalists represent, Chris Hedges, for instance, 20 years Middle East bureau chief at the New York Times, spoke out about the Iraq War, and he didn't last much longer, and he was at the pinnacle of his career. Jonathan Cook now writes a fantastic blog. Oh, by the way, Chris Hedges writes for Truthdig. I recommend everyone read his stuff. Jonathan Cook, who now writes the blog from Nazareth, which again everyone should read, has written extensively about his time at The Guardian and his younger days, and all the subtle barriers that he came up against when he tried to keep his integrity. Both of them couldn't do it. They had to leave. Isn't the answer to become independent?
Yeah.
That's great. Next question.
John's got to leave at half seven, so that's why. Okay, I wanted to take, yes, you've had your hand up for a long time, and then James.
Hi, I'm Kevin McLaughlin from Derry in the north of Ireland, and I've been a journalist for 20 years, ex-BBC, thankfully now. I want to ask you about something I thought about for recently quite a lot, a word, scarerism. Which to me is as a journalist now, I want to know how we start to repel scarerism from editors. So it's really peddling the stories that we get from the establishment that really are covering and masking the real stories that are out there that need to be uncovered.
Okay, we've had four now, so we should probably take some response. Respond now, otherwise we'll get them.
Right.
Can you remember?
Yeah, no, it's a test. okay, yours. Yeah. Why do journalists, should journalists represent the people? Yes. Of course. But as Martha Gellhorn famously said, all journalism should be from the ground up, not from the top down. It almost never is. And that's something, again, I have to say, that has to be taught to young journalists, and isn't. These basic things that you do, you, the most reliable sources of, not of all the truth, but of a way of finding the truth, are to be found at ground level. That's my experience as a reporter. And I had to find out that the people who were above ground level, especially up there, were unreliable sources. Although a number of people may have seen the same car accident and famously gave a slightly different description of it, but broadly they told the truth. Those at the top saw the same car accident and be a different car. That's what should be. You're absolutely right. Independence is number one. Journalists as agents of people, and I mean agents, because people want to know what's going on. And journalists' job, in a nutshell, is to keep the record straight as best they can. They can't do it perfectly. There isn't a whole truth. There are fragments of it. But to get as many of those fragments and put them together as possible. There isn't, from the top down, there are no fragments. There is a true agenda dressed up with impartiality and objectivity. If you
deconstruct most major stories that involve any form of politics, you'll find that the news will represent the political system. It will represent both sides, as if both sides have some sort of claim on the truth, some sort of claim on objectivity. The idea of challenging both sides, which is what my colleagues about the Iraq War were saying, and what Dan Rather was saying with the second sentence, and he was talking about the White House press corps, and anyone who asked the second question in the White House was usually on their way out. A third question, they'd be banned for life, literally. I mean, Helen Thomas, who died recently, the famous independent-minded White House correspondent, she dared to ask a few of those questions. And she was blackballed, literally. These days, you don't even get into the room. You used to be able to get into the room, so you could ask a few rogue questions quickly. And follow up quickly. But then you'd get the dark looks, not necessarily from the people answering the questions, but from all your colleagues. So yes, that's what they should do. Forgotten the other questions.
Have you been in danger?
Have I been? Yep.
This is a question directed at Des. I've read your book, which is brilliant and wonderfully well written.
I work with James, in case anyone...
I'm going to ask you a very difficult question. The contradictions you talk about work out in the past, so the Daily Mail could be a fascist paper in the 30s, support the Beveridge Social Democratic Report in the 40s. But how do the contradictions work out in present-day Britain?
I want you to take that first, actually.
Well, I don't know if they're contradictions as so much as opportunism, which is very different. I mean, the contradictions I talk about at length and using some boring terminology are the structural contradictions that you find in the world in which we live. So the idea of the contradictions between social production and private appropriation, that creates real tensions. And it also creates real tensions in the minds of those people who are engaged in this. So we don't hold simple, you know, one block of ideas. None of us. We hold contradictory ideas. And the point, that for me is quite productive, because it means that there is always that space for different types of readings, different types of action, depending on, you know, how you get together. But those are real contradictions which you can't just wish away, which I think are different to the, you know, the opportunism that you saw of the Mirror in 2003 was a welcome one. But, you know, you could spend your time just saying, you know, this was about boosting their circulation next to the sun. You could do that, and it's true. But what was more important is, why did they feel the need to do this? It's because, you know, when you have a left-wing weatherman, well, he's not left-wing. He was just, I guess, he felt that that's where the weather was that day. And that's more interesting, is how do you play on these on these contradictions, and they are there with us the whole time. But sometimes many people, lots of academics as well, are so quick either to talk about new technologies, whatever they may be, as these empowering, wonderful, innovative, we hear a lot of innovation, that try and get to grips with that, or just absolutely condemn as if there is no space. And what I think is important is to hold on to the productive power of contradictions, which you find everywhere. The most obvious contradiction is that the British press in recent years have launched a war against, we will talk about Leveson maybe another time or later or whatever, but those newspapers launched a war on Leveson as this would enslave the British press and be the end of free speech. In how many newspapers did the majority of readers agree with the editors? How many newspapers? None. Not a one. Not even, although I don't say it outside this room, in the Mail. Mail readers disagreed with Paul Dacre I mean, none of his journalists presumably disagree with him, I guess. It's not worth it. So there are real contradictions, which I think is different to the sort of, you know, and contradiction is a tough word because some people just use it to mean they're confused as well. There's lots of confusions. I give the example in the book, you know, there's no point talking about all the theorization of social media today in books like The End of Big, which was published by a huge multinational publisher. I mean, you're going to have fun with that. That's not really the kind of contradiction I'm talking about. But I hope that answers the question.
I've read the book and it's also brilliant. But
it's also contradictory.
But you talk about here, this is just me abusing my power here, the contradictions of media power, rather than contradictions just generally in all sorts of ways in which the media environment and the media landscape plays out. You're talking about contradictions of media power. Reading it, sometimes you think, really, you actually think it's an increase in control around media power rather than the contradictions. Are you just trying to live up to your optimistic character?
Well, yes, I am. John, you're going to have to help me out. No, why would you separate the structural contradictions that you see in so many spheres of life from its expression in the media, from the way in which it is, ordinary journalists try and negotiate these contradictions every day. And most of the time, they do it in such a way as you wouldn't notice them. That's true. But then that's the point of media activists, of socialists, of radical activists, which is their job is to make things more difficult, to create the sorts of pressure that it makes it impossible, even inside what John describes as the propaganda system of the media. Even there, you start to open these things up.
Yeah.
And I think that's... So for me, I mean, there was a very interesting question as part of your question ages ago about who has the power now? Is it government giving up their power to other sorts of forces? You know, is it private power, government power? In a way, I think it's hard to separate them to a certain extent, partly because you're seeing a revolving door. Mm-hmm. You know, so many of our leading politicians are ex-PR people, or going to soon be PR, particularly in the US. How can this system, as complex as we are told that it is, and as academics keep reminding everybody, there is a level of simplicity between the sorts of connections that take place. Hopefully I'll try and identify some of those.
I would agree with that. The man in the orange and then the man in the middle.
Thank you. John and Des, you both mentioned the word truth on a number of occasions this evening. But the problem is that your truth and my truth are probably completely different. It's a bit like one man's terrorist, etc., and freedom fighters and all this sort of argument. How do we get to the truth without relying on Russia Today and sources like this? Where is the truth? What is the truth?
Okay, well,
sorry,
hold
it's
that.
a long
question. Hold that very easy question. What is the truth? While we go to the next.
Very similar there. There was the three relatively interesting developments as we seek alternative sources of news that I was going to mention. There was there's The Intercept, which is Glenn Greenwald's in the US, but basically run by a very wealthy individual. Then you've got, I was going to mention Russia Today, and is that the antidote to the BBC? That it may not be perfect, but it's an alternative viewpoint, which if you watch the two, you may actually get different opinions. And the final one is actually the truth. And Des, you mentioned Russell Brand. I've got 100 followers, John's got a few thousand, and 30,000, I think, and 8.5 million, and it may not be everyone's taste, but it's a really interesting development that you've got somebody who has been given a voice and has basically spoken truth to power. So just any of those three that you could mention as being interesting to you.
And then we're going to come down here. But let's do truth and alternatives.
Go on.
Yeah.
Russell Brand shames us. Russell, why is there such a popular interest in what he has to say, apart from the fact that he is a
a famous celebrity and a comedian. It's because there is a yawning gap, and the gap is so yawning that in steps Russell Brand in, well, I don't in any way want to be critical of Russell Brand, because I think Russell Brand in his book has said some very basic truisms that people have responded to, because there are no popular politics anymore. There is no truly popular media anymore. There is a kind of dumbed down kind of popular media of a kind, but there isn't a popular media anymore. That is one that tries to make sense of all those issues and problems that touch ordinary people's lives. Russell Brand, I doubt, in when that front page you saw was published back in the late 70s, certainly earlier than that, had he said what he said, it would have been that much in the newspaper, because it was being said. It's shaming, utterly, and good on him. Good on him. But what he represents is this massive gap, this massive vacuum. I mean, you mentioned truth. I said fragments of truth. There's, unless you want a divinity of some kind, there isn't the truth. There are pieces of truth, and they can fit together, and they often are the result of a collection of facts and a perspective. Who knows? We're entering an abstraction now. But so you're quite right. There are different truths, and though all those truths should be represented, but there are only some truths that will add up to telling people what the hell is going on in a particular situation. So I'm sorry, that's an inadequate answer to your question, but I know as little as you about what truth is.
Yes, well, Alan Hunter makes his way over here. Can you tell me about real alternatives? Because in your final chapter, you do tackle that question.
Can I not talk about truths?
Just no. Okay. No, of course you can.
Just a couple of truths. One is, you know, this is, sometimes it's useful to be an academic, that has revealed that there is a systematic favouring of Israeli government spokespeople over Palestinians in the most recent Gaza conflict. That there is this was a really interesting study done about newspaper coverage for elite newspapers, not mainstream, but elite newspapers in Britain from 2010 to 2013, looking at their coverage of the economic crisis. And they found that 54% were economists who were quoted as experts, 1% were trade unionists, 1%. Now that's a small fact, but it's a significant fact which helps to explain the sorts of coverage we get. I think you can build on truths from there. But alternatives. The alternatives I'd go through are two, very simply. One is the kinds of it's about the anti-war movement and the impact it had in sections of the media. And by that, I just don't mean it starts or stops the anti-war movement. It's about building those kinds of social movements which will have an impact in many different areas of life. Without that, I don't think we're going to see the sorts of change that many of us want. And the other was slightly more controversially, or maybe more narrow, was about media reform. I mean, it's my day job, I suppose, to a certain extent. But, you know, where I agree with everything that John and other people have said about Leveson in terms of it's a talking shop, it was sealed, it was, all of that is true, but it's easy to be true like that. And the fact is, unless you also recognise that it afforded an opportunity for ordinary people to hear the stories that they probably know already, but there they are in some of the newspapers that they don't normally trust, It gives us a space to start to go beyond that. And if you don't try, and if you don't try and make those sorts of arguments about, you know, this is a level of corruption that is not to be believed, unless you start to think, well, what do we do about it in lots of different ways? It seems to me to be a wasted opportunity. So I'm talking about media reform, but from a much more radical perspective, that it's not just about politely gathering signatures, even though probably lots of us do that. It's going beyond that. And I think that's in a long tradition of revolutionaries and radicals who engage in reformist movements, but they may have slightly different ends. And if we do it, you know, to get equal pay, if we do it to get civil rights, why should we not do it inside the media as well?
You can have radical reformism.
Okay. Hi. This is a question to both John and Des. My name is Mo. I'm working on a thesis at the moment where I'm questioning the freedom of speech, to what extent we have it in across the news media. And I'm looking at the John Snowden case, amongst others, and there's so many avenues that I'm getting a really bit lost here. There's so many questions to ask. But I saw an interview recently with Julian Assange, with Afsin Ratansi, and I also know he spoke to you, but he did mention something which I thought was quite troubling in terms of there has been an increase of people who have access to state, security access in USA. Since 2010, there used to be 2.5 million, and now there's 6 million people, and these are all like becoming a state within a state. So, but they all have their own laws and their own regulations, and they're talking about that the people who should make the decisions on what's to be published in the press is the State Department. What is your comment on that? And my question is kind of like, the truth tellers such as Snowden and Assange, they end up being locked up. Then there's there's some great reporters like yourselves who are struggling to get the news out, the truth out, whatever the truth is. So where are we going if the State Department has to decide everything?
Well, the State Department, unfortunately, doesn't run the world yet. It's sort of...
Thank God.
But yes, I saw that interview with Julian, and he's talked about 6.6 million people with national security clearance. And his view is that it's now a great phenomenon of power, often competing within itself for certain rewards of that power. That competition is quite interesting in itself. And it has various showcases, political showcases, but it's a huge phenomenon of power. I don't agree that Snowden or Assange failed. I think Snowden, take the more recent one, actually revealed this. Extraordinary. He revealed it, and so did Assange, and so did Chelsea Manning. Certainly in the so-called mainstream, the revelations, the early WikiLeaks revelations, were constrained in The Guardian. That was about 5% of what they had. And if you go across the world in various WikiLeaks revelations in countries that are germane to various developments in those countries, you see the extraordinary disclosures, the scale of disclosures, the impact of those disclosures. I think those disclosures are just about the most exciting thing to have happened in my career. The reaction was so violent, again, because it shamed all those who were meant to be keeping the record straight. That basically what they were telling us, how governments lie to us while they say something very different in private, governments and their vested interests. The very thing that a critical public intelligence has long suspected and probably known. There was confirmation that they were doing it. It was the very best kind of journalism, in my experience as a reporter, the best
the best and most effective, whoever asked the question about effective journalism, always starts with a whistleblower, someone within the system. And it's and that's what Snowden and Manning and Assange were and are on a spectacular level. So I find that I very much share Des's optimism generally, but I think that is a very concrete cause for optimism. It's made all the right people so angry. You know, that's the measure, always. When they get angry and then the smears begin and the disinformation and all that, the machine works that way. And on those three, I won't go into Assange and Snowden, but Manning in the United States was virtually in the news a non-person. His trial, although it was open, his military trial, although it was open to the media, was barely reported in the so-called mainstream. In fact, it came down to Gavin?
Alexa, right?
Yeah. And had the one wonderful woman who sat through transcribing the whole thing and then put it out in the early hours of the next morning. Some of it absolutely spectacular in what this man was saying and what he'd seen. It was suppressed. And the various, and Assange suppressed much of it. Snowden, not so much. But you know, that development is something that should give us great cause for hope, I think.
I'm going to take one more handful of questions, and then we are going to have to finish because John has to go, and we're all going to be over here because that's where the mic is. Angela, then straight behind him, the gentleman at the back.
I wanted to pick up on the question of optimism. Being one of those people who actually do teach journalism. And I wanted to say really that I think one of the things that's missing here is that of course there is power, there will always be power. Journalism, when it is working properly, will always operate in opposition to whatever power there is, but there will always be power. And I wanted to just remind us that there have been social movements that have been really quite successful, and one of the ones that never gets remembered but is probably the most successful is feminism. And I don't think we should forget about it. I don't think that that what women have done over the last 30 years, 40 years, I don't think we've really heard that raised today. In the early 1970s, women did not have equal pay. Women, I think it's difficult for young women today to even imagine what it was like to be a woman in the early 1970s. And I think that change did happen, and it happened because there was a social movement that worked, operated both outside, it operated in the streets, it operated in workplaces, it operated in the trade unions, it also operated in the media. And change is possible, but it never happens as fast as any of us want it to. But I would just like to sort of reiterate that, as Des said, you know, power is there, but so is resistance, and if you look for it, you'll always find it.
But look at the media has done to feminism. Yeah. Look at the media has done to feminism.
I want to have an argument about it.
No,
quite
why
happy
not?
To. But I don't think that's what
why
I'm
not?
Here for.
Look at the media has done to feminism. Probably the greatest distortion of feminism has been in the media.
I'm quite happy to have this argument, but I think it would
no,
be...
No, let me answer what you've just said. Let me answer what you've just said. You've said there's been a successful socialism. True. That's absolutely true. I'm not quite sure what that has to do with the media, which is the subject here. What does have to do with the media is the distortion of feminism. Women are used and abused constantly throughout the media. Women calling themselves feminists in the media present an image of women that is very contrary to the very thing that you're quite rightly celebrating. That's what I think salient in the media. I don't why you. I agree with you. Basically, it's a wonderful social movement it's enjoyed all those successes, in spite of the media, in spite of the media.
Well, thank you.
Hi, Nina Williams, student on digital journalism. My question is actually to John, drawing on your experience of Cambodia. Last week I was at a conference entitled Why Are People Fleeing from the Horn of Africa, in particular with regards Eritrea. And I was shocked to actually find that apparently the country has the highest number of journalists with a number of atrocities which nobody knows about. And I think my question is, in a world where we are sort of with competing atrocities, and if you like, we are very much numbed by all that is actually happening in the world, what is your advice to journalists who want to try and bring these stories to the fore?
I know what you're saying. I don't think we're numbed. But I think the way these terrible things, as in Eritrea, are presented to us, certainly almost conspire to numb us, because they don't make sense of it. The news becomes a kind of moving belt of surreal images of disaster. I mean, as I mentioned, just coming here tonight, listening to this almost chipmunk voice telling us that all of these atrocities, from terrible things like beheadings and refugees and the very things, the deaths of journalists and so on, how can you not be numbed? Listen, it's almost impossible to take in. There was something some years ago being promoted, and it was actually promoted by broadcasters, saying there was a compassion fatigue. There wasn't a compassion fatigue. There was a fatigue on the part of broadcasters to actually make sense and portray all these things in the world, contextualize them, give people at least a glimpse of not only that it happened, but why it happened. So I think it comes down again to a problem of media. I think people do respond. I know in my own experience, having reported from places of great distress, stricken places, from Cambodia to East Timor, Eritrea was one of them, I've known the popular reaction. I don't mean the elite reaction, I mean a truly popular reaction. It's anything but numbed. You know, something like 40-odd million pounds were raised for Cambodia, most of it in small amounts from people, all of it unsolicited, none of it from people who are numbed. These days, because there's such a tsunami of unexplained horror through the news, that I think people, rather than being numbed, simply don't hear it or try not to hear it, or turn away from it. And that's perfectly understandable. It says that we in the media are not doing our job.
We are almost out of time. I'm going to give the final word to Des.
Well, it was so that you leave on an optimistic note, yeah. Once again, which was just in amongst all the unexplained chaos, the decontextualized mess that's presented to us, all the fake experts, and the lack of any kind of systematic explanation. I do go back to one strange morning, I think it was the 2nd of January, it was around New Year this year, when this weird thing happened on Radio 4, not the place you might expect to hear weird things, which is that I woke up and heard John's voice and PJ Harvey's musical voice. And you thought, what has happened to us in this? Have they gone mad at Radio 4? It's a kind of another media is possible type moment. And I just think, we don't think
of that. It was a conspiracy, Dad.
It was an utter conspiracy.
And there was reviews throughout the BBC how this conspiracy could have been.
But how fantastic they felt the need both to commission it and then to say, we must never do this again.
We had balance the next day.
Well, there's balance for 364 days, but that day shows you, first of all, another media could be possible, but why did they choose PJ Harvey, apart from that she's a fantastic musician? Because something is going on that they felt a need to express, and then obviously someone got sacked for doing this. It's the same with Russell. The same with Russell Brand. Good that he's there. You know, he's got two things going for him. One is he lives in Essex. He's from Essex. The second thing is he does have 8.5, well, however many million followers it is, because not just because he's a good-looking fella, because he is speaking things that people want to hear. So if we go away and think of that, you know, we need more Russell Brands, more people who are going to ask those questions. And if the book does anything to encourage people to do that, then it was worth a few months of
absolutely
loneliness.
What a fantastic place to end. Please read the book.
Thank you for coming.